tonight we have a real treat because we have one of our own speaking through David Brown. Most of you that have been here before know David, and he starts praying to you. David, and I don't know, is this the reason you wore your hat or not? A graduate of the University of Texas with a degree in anthropology. I thought they didn't play until Friday.
Is it Thursday night or Friday?
It's Thursday night.
Oh, all right.
Okay. Good. So, anyway, David went to the University of Texas, and then he has a law degree from SMU, and he's a practicing attorney here in the city of Dallas in commercial real estate. But he almost had, tells me, almost has a degree in philosophy, and longtime member of the Dallas Philosophers Forum. Guy that really likes ideas, and I know he's actually spoken to this group and many other groups in the area several times. And tonight, as you can see, he's going to be talking about philosophy and mythology. So with that, David, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Jack. Good evening, everybody. I've been attending this group. It was Bob Berman who introduced me to this group. I'm very grateful for that. Gosh, it's been at least 10 years now, and I don't think we've ever had mythology as a topic. So, kind of in the interest of mixing it up, I thought, it's a subject we ought to treat of. And I gave it kind of the academic teaser title, subtitle, Toys for Children or Supernormal Sign Stimuli. And hopefully that kind of kept you on the edge of your seats, all this time, what the hell we're talking about. But all will be revealed here. We're going to start with the Toys for Children part, and then kind of build up the supernormal sign stimuli. I'll say that for last. But both of these terms are references to Joseph Campbell. He wrote a lot of material around the subject of philosophy, but in my opinion, his magnum opus is the four-volume series, The Mask of God, that has a volume on primitive mythology, a volume on occidental mythology, a volume on oriental mythology, and a volume on creative mythology, which is modern. And when Campbell uses the word toys for children, this would be a way of characterizing the treatment of mythology as a subject from the vantage point of philosophy, Western philosophy, that is, from more or less the time of Descartes to the time of Kant. Kind of the areas we refer to as the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason. And the reason it's called Toys for Children is, the analogy goes something like this. In childhood and child development, there's a time when children believe in Santa Claus, and Santa Claus comes down and rides the sleigh and all that. And then, at some point in their development, they find out that, they find out it's really mom and dad that supplies presents. So they move from a childish view to an adult view. And on that model, the Toys for Children notion of mythology would say that mythological viewpoints are held in the immaturity of the human race. And then when we acquire a low-dose reason, scientific method, we move beyond that to a more adult understanding, and we leave behind mythological ways of thinking. And so, from that standpoint, there really wouldn't be very much to talk about in terms of philosophy and mythology, because it's simply an immature stage, where things are poorly understood, that's superseded by the scientific worldview and so forth. But what I'd like to talk about are some alternatives to that point of view that have emerged in several thinkers over the 19th and 20th century and harken back to some older ideas before Descartes. We get our word for mythology, like so many of our concepts, from the Greek mythos. And the normal contrast is with logos, which is also a Greek term that stands for logical, deductive, reasoning, logical reasoning, Aristotle's syllogisms, those kind of things. And so normally we would counterpoise those as opposites of each other. And in the Toys for Children model, we simply grow from mythos to the more Superior logos as we develop. And it's been said by Whitehead that all Western philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato. So taking that to heart, I want to go back and look at mythology and Plato's works. If you look at the Republic, Plato clearly was critical of the kind of mythology presented by Homer and Hesiod in the Greek tradition. Primarily, he was critical because the views of the gods put forth in Homer were not the kind of morally uplifting views that a Platonic guardian ought to have. For, you know, they depicted gods who were supposedly superior, you know, being fickle, changing their mind, being punitive, vengeful, pulling tricks, being deceitful and all that, and Plato didn't make it his utopian republic that was ideal. And so he would severely censor, root out mythology, at least in the Homeric sense. And so some people would put forth the idea, therefore, that Plato really was anti-mythological in his viewpoint. But exactly, yeah. Exactly. There are several examples where Plato made use of myth. You can debate whether the cave is really a metaphor or a myth, but he introduces in the Republic a tale of the Pamphylian which basically is a tale of the immortality of the soul that he introduces by way of myth, just kind of out of the blue. But that's not the only use of Plato for myth. And the Phaedo, also treating its subject of immortality of the soul, Socrates says, of course, no reasonable man ought to insist that the facts are exactly as I have described them, but that either this or something very like it is a true account. This, I think, is both a reasonable construct and a risk worth taking. We should use such accounts to inspire ourselves with confidence. So Socrates is sort of kind of prefacing his use of myth as, you know, maybe it's not true in the same sense that historical fact is true, but maybe it's instructive, or maybe something like this is true. And then Plato in the Symposium used the myth of human beings that were created with two faces back to back. Some of them were male on one side, male on the other, you know, female on one side, female on the other. There were, I guess, six different combinations, and that they were split in the middle. And that's why we see, union in a sexual relationship, which we're trying to merge back with our other half. You know, clearly a mythic treatment, not as intended as literal history, of basically sexual attraction. And in the Gorgias dialogue, Socrates also says, give ear then, as they say, to a very fine story, which you, I suppose, would consider fiction, but I consider fact. For what I'm going to tell you is the actual truth. And then he proceeds to tell about how Zeus, Poseidon, and Plato divided up the various kingdoms of the sea and the earth and the underworld between them. And then finally, and famously, in the Critias dialogue, Plato introduces the myth of Atlantis, which is, you know, probably the main source of the myth of Atlantis, you know, kind of being of interest in Western culture, is that Plato brought in for illustrative purposes. So the Greeks in Plato and in the use of the mysteries, the Eleusinian mysteries, definitely used myth. And Aristotle maybe not so much. Aristotle didn't have quite as much use for myth as Plato did, but he definitely was part of Hellenic culture through this period of time. And the Greeks learned to allegorize myth. Philo did this both to the Greek myths and to the Hebrew scriptures. He was an Alexandrian Hellenistic Jew. And so he looked at both the Hebrew Bible and the Greek myths from an allegorical viewpoint. And then Origen, one of the early Christian fathers in the second century, similarly used an allegorical approach to Christian scriptures in saying more or less, it doesn't matter so much whether this is historically true. What matters is the mythic idea. But Origen did not win out as the orthodoxy of the creed and the Christian orthodoxy. And up through the Middle Ages, Christianity adopted more of an attitude of myth as being more or less a falsehood, you know, kind of a false story, and privileged the New Testament stories as being revelation as opposed to myth. And created this dichotomy between revelation, which is true, and myth, which is false, you know, which is really kind of a way of saying, a myth in my culture is true. A myth in any other culture is false. It's my way of thinking, very ethnocentric approach. But this is kind of what we were left with through the Middle Ages. But kind of jumping ahead now to post-Kantian thought. In the 19th century, the discipline of anthropology really developed. There really was no anthropology before that. And pioneers of anthropology, such as Malinowski, Levi Strauss, people like that, developed a definition of myth in an entirely different sense than a falsehood that is believed by children or childish races that is eventually transcended. And what definition the anthropologists came up with is that myth is primarily a story about origins, about how something came to be. And it is in contrast to a fable, legend, folk tale, other kind of tales that are told but are not recognized as having the significance of really explaining the origin of the cosmos, the origin of, you know, the division of the tribes. And these mythic events were felt to take place in a trans-historical time. The Australian Aborigines refer to this as dream time. And it's really a time that is just as you can enter the dream state, you know, by going to sleep and go in and out of it. It's a time that's not before historical time. It's not after historical time. It's really every time. It's transcendent time. And myth sees the source of the mundane world in this dream time. And even more importantly than that, the source only produces the mundane time if there is some reenactment or participation in the myth periodically to renew it. And so the primitive view of the myth is kind of like a spring that if you don't, you know, if it eventually runs out, it runs dry and has to be renewed. And so to the anthropological view, a myth is not just to be told, a story to be told and heard, but a story to be participated in, felt, lived, embodied. And that's the true meaning of myth. It's an origin story which is meant to be embodied and acted out and lived. And the early anthropologists took what was called a structural functional view of myth, which is that the reason the tribes do this is to reinforce a social structure in the tribe. And the myth is kind of the glue, in effect, that holds this social structure together. And in primitive tribes, usually only the boys, sometimes maybe the girls too, participate in an initiation rite at puberty, where the myths are disclosed to them for the first time, and they go through the experience of transcending their childhood and emerging as an adult member of the tribe with the knowledge of myth and with participation in rituals that involves some pretty gory stuff, you know, not only circumcision, but sub-incision, and, you know, all kinds of nasty stuff like that, which is intended to mark the person of the culture apart from the natural world, because you're born in the world a certain way, you know, but you only get these kind of marks and scars, you know, in a cultural way, being adopted into the culture. So it's your outward sign of being part of that culture in a structural proximity. And then a little later, after the anthropologist kind of developed a theory of myths, the psychologist came along, most notably Freud and Jung. And to Freud, a myth was an neurosis that was, operating in the subconscious and causing the attention to be diverted from the reality principle, from the adaptation to the reality principle. And so the myth to Freud was something to be therapeutically dealt with and more or less exercised. But his pupil, Jung, came along and introduced the idea, you've probably heard of archetypes, as myths producing archetypes. And so to Jung, a myth was not a neurosis to be overcome, but a feature of the soul to be grown and developed and worked on. But there's a reason I put the slide up there, and there's a little bit of a misunderstanding out there, I think, about Jungian archetypes, is that they're out there with content in them, kind of floating around, sort of like a platonic idea, and there's this collective unconsciousness that has all these ideas floating around, and we're all just plugged into it. But that's not actually what Jung said. He made very clear that his archetypes are forms devoid of content. Kind of think in terms of an empty container. The content's not there. You've got the form for it. And it's really the life experience, such as the natural environment, things like the moon, the sun, the seasons, the historical, tribal, or national life. What is the history of the tribe? Is it the exodus out of Egypt and the coming together of the 12 tribes? What historical events define the tribe? The family dynamic, the whole Oedipus Electra complex, all that kind of material. And the fact that we all age and approach death, and how do mythic images help us cope with that? So this content comes into these forms, and to Jung supplies archetypes. And so to Jung, the function of the myth is psychological. So we have a social view of myth from the anthropologist supply, a psychological event coming from Freud and Jung, although a little bit different in each of them. And Joseph Campbell is really the one that tied these together to give us a comprehensive theory of myth, because in Campbell's theory, myth does four different things. I'll start with number three, because that's the one we introduced at the anthropologist. Myth does serve to integrate the individual into the current social order. Myth does serve as the content for these initiation rites that identify someone as a member of the tribe. And that's a valid function. So that's the social function. Number four is the psychological function, that myths also provide spiritual enrichment and realization. And they do further our growth psychologically, as Jung said. But in addition to that, number one, a function of mythology is to elicit and support a sense of awe. Rudolf Otto wrote a book called The Sense of the Holy, where he talked about the newness, that part of an experience that puts us in rapture, trance, arrest, awe, kind of literally takes our breath away. And there's a connection here with Kant, because Kant applied, in the critique of pure reason, his critique of pure reason was that you could not, by logos, i.e. pure reason, get to concepts of either aesthetics or ethics. And so he had to lay that aside. But then in the other two critiques, he laid a basis other than on logos for developing an ethical sense and an aesthetic sense. Both from more of an existential standpoint. And so, from this sense, Kant said there are two things, and I don't know if it's quote that correct, but paraphrase there. There are two things that inspire me to follow: the starry heavens above and the human moral compass within. He's saying that in those you have those kind of awe-inspiring experiences. Those, as when you see a work of art and you're just enraptured by it.
And this would be what Otto's talking about the newness
and the function that a myth can supply, particularly when it is embodied and enacted. Think in terms of the, participating in the Hopi rain dance, and putting on the mask and, representing the bear god or the lion god or something like that. But it would take you into this sort of trance or rest state. So that's
the first function in this list of myth. And then the second function is to render a cosmology that corresponds to the actual experience, knowledge, and mentality of the culture.
Now this part of the myth is the one that probably fits closest to the Toys for Children model, because to the extent that the function of myth is to supply us with a cosmology, the works of Laplace and Einstein and Newton and all that, they've done a pretty good job of supplying us with a cosmology, pretty comprehensive cosmology. And so myth perhaps doesn't have the same function in the modern environment
as to that one of the four functions as it might have had in times past. You might say that has myth really completely displaced,
has science completely displaced myth in terms of the cosmological function? I bought a book by Brian Green, who is a well-known science author, a Pulitzer Prize winner, professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University. And he says, referring to the Big Bang, he says, a common misconception is that the Big Bang provides a theory of cosmic origins. It doesn't. The Big Bang is a theory, partly described in the last two chapters of this book, that delineates cosmic evolution from a split second after whatever happened to bring the universe into existence. And it says nothing at all about time zero itself. And since, according to the Big Bang theory, the bang is what is supposed to happen at the beginning, the Big Bang leads out the bang. It tells us nothing about what bang, why it banged, how it banged, or frankly, whether it ever really banged at all. So even an astute scientist is acknowledging that science as a cosmological theory may have its limits, and if you look to something like the Kabbalah, for example, that might be a way to mythically fill in exactly what he's saying is not filled in by the Big Bang theory. At least a way to approach those kinds of subjects. So, if you look at the way Einstein theorized relativity, it was theorized first without any experimental proof, and then later there was experimental proof, Michael Sibelius experiments and so on that came along to prove it. Now we're getting into areas of string theory, brain theory, and things like that, that people say, well, we don't know if we'll ever come up with an experimental basis to validate or falsify or non-falsify this theory. And so, in some sense, those theories may be serving the function as a mythic cosmology for us, which is not the same as saying false cosmology, useless cosmology, but a mythic. Because the purpose of myth across all four of these is to provide some sense of meaning, purpose, value to the existence, which a pure logical theory, it's hard to do. It's hard to find value in a syllogism. It's hard to find value in a mathematical topology.
And so that's maybe what all four of these functions.
Campbell traces a lot of the anthropological thinking of how myth develops in different times of history. And
we have these caves in southern France where we have the earliest instances of human art. So I'm trying to think what this cave is called. It's, don't have it on there. Come to me here in a minute. These caves are maybe 100 feet below the earth,
have to be accessed through tunnels that you have to crawl through, and you barely squeeze through, you know, crawl maybe for 2 hours to get to this cave. And they would have been doing it at times, you know, when candlelight was the only light. And so, you know, wriggling through this tunnel, getting to the cave, and lighting the candle,
and then creating these images on the wall. Some of which were animals, but this particular image has been dubbed the Sorcerer of Trois Freres. And what it shows is presumably a shaman impersonating by mask what's called the Animal Master.
And we know something about animal masters from some of the hunting and gathering tribes that were still around in the 19th century when anthropologists started doing field studies. And what we know from that is that hunters believe that in order to take an animal's life for food, it is necessary to go through some kind of preparatory ritual, which basically makes it okay with the animal master, who is the one who has charge. You know, if it's antelopes, it's the master antelope. If it's seals, it's the mama seal. And that with the ritual first, then the killing of the animal is sanctioned, and the animal becomes more or less a willing victim then of that, kind of a participant in it. But without that ritual, it's, the worst taboo that could possibly be done. And it's theorized that this was done to assuage the feelings of guilt that early humans had, because they knew that to survive and eat was necessary to take the life of another animal. So it was theorized that there would get permission to kill these animals, from their master. Presumably rituals were enacted in these caves where the animal master would be impersonated, permission would be asked, he would give the directions for the rituals to be undertaken before the hunting was sanctioned, and then, the tribes would go out and perform the ritual. There also were pictures of these, animals on the cave, and it's believed that they served something like platonic forms or ideals that by symbolizing putting an arrow through an antelope on the cave wall, that you were just like in mythic, that what happens in the dream time influences the mundane, that by doing that on the cave wall, you were causing the successful hunt to happen on the outside. So we have these wonderful art relics of this hunting mythology, which seems to be more or less uniform from different cultural regions. And I'll get some of the elements of that here in a little bit. But let me go next to the next image. Although the hunting society was largely patriarchal and masculine in terms of who was initiated into the myths and the secrets and all that, there was nevertheless quite a bit of awe and worship of the power of the feminine. And here we have the image that's on a stone wall in southern France, not too far actually from where the cave with the other one is, referred to as the Venus of Losel, and obviously pregnant female with a bison horn in her hand, symbolizing one of the hunt animals, and indicating that from very early time there was a reverence for the feminine as that which gives source to life, where life emerges from, as being a very powerful mansion. That must be respected and helpful.
So in the various hunting mythologies, the themes that emerge in common, which we've kind of touched on, is that death happens because of magic and violence. And so therefore, dead humans are dangerous spirits to be defended against. And so there's a big difference between burial ritual in hunting tribes and clearing tribes. In hunting tribes, the dead tend to be kind of tied up in manacles, where they can't kind of come out and do harm, and they perform ceremonies to basically beg the ghosts to go away and leave people alone because, people are afraid that maybe they might be a little bit resentful. It's probably the image that survives in our vampire and all that kind of, the dead that's really not so grateful that kind of wants to come back and get us. So I think we still have that kind of in our subconscious. But on the other hand, animals are willing victims of a sacrifice, and they're only temporarily dead. They go back and forth from the dream world like acid through later. So the hunting cultures tended to believe that the antelope that was killed with the proper ritual would go to the happy hunting ground for a while and then would come back. I mean, that's how the population was replenished, which is another reason why they had to do the ritual correctly. Because if you killed the animal without the ritual, not only would the animal master be pissed off, but the animal would come back, so eventually you'd run out of them. So this was an important part. But the shaman was a special person who had made the deal with the animal master, knew the secrets, knew how to do the ritual. And the shaman was the person in this culture that was felt to have more interior depth, better access to the screen time, mythic reality, therefore able to come explain the deaths and how they should be acted to the other more normal people of the tribe. Having to do this kind of skimming, you could do a whole lot of time just on the particulars of these, but let me move on to the feminine, as illustrated by the Venus of Lhasa, has the power of life-giving magic. And then a final theme that's pretty common is that there's a trickster figure. Sometimes it's a rabbit, like Burr Rabbit, sometimes it's a coyote, sometimes it's like Bernard the Fox, but there's this trickster character that kind of shakes up the order a little bit. And Prometheus is a firebringer in Greek mythology, for example, is kind of the best trickster figure. Somebody that kind of upsets the order, of the divine world, the heavens or whatever, and sort of, kind of mischievous, but nevertheless helps out humans from time to time. Moving to the planting mythologies, I'm going to do this and then back up to the pictures. In the planting cultures, you have some of the same themes but transformed a little bit. In the planting mythologies, it's generally believed that death entered the world via a murder. We have a vestige of this in the Hebrew Bible in the story of Cain and Abel. Usually the death would precede basically what we have as a Garden of Eden story, but the Hebrew Bible kind of inverts the usual order. But generally you have the death first, and it's before the death, you were in the dream time, meaning that you had no sexual generation, you didn't need it because there was no death, right? Everybody was just there all the time, so you didn't need to replenish the generations. But there was this murder that caused the world as we know it to come into existence, and that the food plant, whether it's rice or wheat or some kind of root crop or something like that, the food crop that the culture depends on really grows out of the body of that sacrificed victim. And so therefore, and sex entered the world at the same time because, for me to die, in need sexual reproduction. Got to get replaced in the population. And so, on the principle that myth has to be acted out, then the way to ensure that the food crop continues to grow and that the rains continue to come and so forth is to ritually participate in that act. So you have all these cults that the prophets in the Hebrew Bible were so afraid against, about the ritual sex and the human sacrifice, once a year to cause the crops to grow. And the moon was observed to go through this cycle, where it would be light and then gradually dark, and then for 3 days it was entirely dark, and then come back to light again. And that was held to represent a cycle of a dying and reborn god. And identified with the moon, there was the figure of the snake. Why? Because the snake sheds its skin and grows a new skin, which is kind of seen like a death and rebirth motif. The boar and the bull, because they have horns that look like the crescent and the moon. The goddess, going back to the Venus of Wassel, that all kind of carried forward into the planting culture. The goddess has the power to resurrect the dead god. So the goddess is, on the one hand, life-giving, on the second hand, destructive. So in the Hindu tradition, you have Kali, who appears in one image with black and blood, dripping out of her mouth and all that. On the other hand, there's the mother figure. So you have this kind of two-sided figure of the feminine. And this myth you have in almost all of ancient cultures. So Osiris and Isis in Egypt. Osiris is the dead, the reborn god. Isis is the feminine, who goes down to the underworld to rescue. In Greek culture, Demeter and Persephone. In Adonis, also in another form of the Greek culture, Tammuz in Babylonia. Pretty universal theme happening here. But then as the planting cultures developed into cities, with enough of an agricultural surplus to have priests and kings and specialists and tradesmen, that's what's called the hieratic city-state. Hieratic being kind of derived from the same word as hierarchy, meaning that there's a pyramidal structure with priests and kings on top instead of just a shaman who's kind of like everybody else, but maybe a little bit more sensitive to these mythological themes. And the priest observed the heavenly bodies, the precession of the equinoxes, and the sun, and the moon, and the stars, and all that, and observed the regularity of that. And it was felt that if the court of the king observed that same order, everything would be okay. And in the context of the Nile and the Euphrates, the floods would come on time, and wouldn't be too much, they'd be regular, all this kind of order. And so the king symbolically was felt to represent the moon system. And in the early stages, that meant that like the moon, he had to be sacrificed and be killed. And so you have all this archaeological evidence of kings being sacrificed when the priests look at the stars and they said, okay, kind of like we're looking now at the Mayan calendar says 2012 cycles over. If the astronomers look, the priests look and set the cycles over, then the king's time would be up. And he would have to step down so that the new king and the new cycle came up. And a lot of these kings would bring with them all kinds of flute players and attendants and all this. And so they would sacrifice the king and bury him with maybe as many as 200 of his court attendants as part of this. And the other individuals, the ministers, serve the hierarchy here. So let me go back now to the... So we have all these, I think both of these images are from Sumerian, of this concept of the snake is shedding its skin, embodying this death and rebirth. You have the moon figure there, the crescent moon. You have the flower there, and then you have a tree with two fruits growing off of it. The tree, in the days of the shaman, was an image of transcendence. Both the bird and the tree were identified with the shaman. And symbolically, this ascendance was a contact with the stream world, this archetypal world. And so here you have the identification of the, and you see the similarity to our Caduceus, our school of the medical field. And you can also start to see a similarity with the themes in the Garden of Eden. This idea of the garden and the serpent and the two fruits and the maiden and all that is not at all unique to the Hebrew scriptures. It's really found in all the old cultures, but slightly, you know, give it a little bit different flavor and interwoven. Here's another one where you have the snake on the left, the tree with the two fruits, the goddess on the left, and then the horned god with horns, kind of like the bull or the boar on the right, reaching out for the fruits of the garden, which in the Hebrew story is the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil and the fruit of the tree of life. And then you have here the moon bull. The moon is symbolizing this lunar dead and resurrected god being bitten and pounced on the back by a figure that is a little bit like a lion and a little bit like an eagle. The lion and the eagle were both symbols of a solar mythology that came in and kind of pushed out this earlier lunar mythology to varying degrees. And it more or less corresponds to the time of the Iron Age cultures, the herding cultures with the horse, iron swords coming in and overrunning these earlier Bronze Age cultures, which happened in Greece, happened in India with the Aryans overrunning the Dravidian culture. It happened with Shang, China, overcoming the prior Bronze Age cultures. And it happened with the Hebrews coming in and conquering Canaan. You know, Canaan was more of the Bronze Age culture, you know, with Baal and Astarte and all that, and the Hebrews were more of the solar. And the image of the solar mythology is that, unlike the moon, which changes within, it's sometimes light, sometimes dark, alternating, the sun has a daily cycle, but when it comes up above the horizon, it immediately slays or kills the moon and all the stars and everything else. So instead of this interior cycle of change, you have this external god coming in and basically taking dominion over everything else, taking dominion over the other god. So it's kind of easy to see how you get from that idea of a solar mythology to an external god in heaven. You know, much more like a solar image than a lunar image, which is more intimate. So you have this this progression of the solar and the lunar mythology coming together in what Campbell calls the four great culture domains. And these are the areas where, in what's called the Axial Age, which is roughly from about 800 BCE to 200 BCE, you have cultural traditions emerging that were particularly influential on later culture. And Campbell has this way of kind of characterizing, you know, kind of the principal image of each one that, you know, seems pretty apt to me, that in India what emerged as the signature of that culture is the idea of the yogi sitting in the lotus posture on the mountaintop in this rapturous arrest because he's in contact with this void that's at the same time in the Brahman, which is the void, is Atman, is the eminence within. And so the signature flavor, if you will, of the Indian culture domain to Campbell would be the meditating yogi with his eyes closed, you know, sort of absorbed in this void. And there's a little bit of influence in there from the tropical planting zone that the Aryan invaders, you know, didn't quite stamp out. The Aryans came in, overcame the Dravidians, made them the lower caste in the Hindu system, but really were kind of permeated by this Bronze Age influence. In China, on the other hand, what emerged is the idea of the wandering sage. You know, it's not the yogi sitting eyes closed in meditation, but the sage out
wandering in the world, but nevertheless very wise, living in harmony with both the natural order and the social order. Kind of harmony, balance between yin and yang, being the
cultural theme in signature of the Chinese culture. There's a shamanic element in China, and shamans, so there's influence from the Arctic hunting zone that we talked about still evident. In the Levantine culture, which the culture is the Middle East, you have this idea in all three of the monotheistic Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, of the idea of a supernatural revelation and the one true community under God. Community defined different ways. One true community under God, to the Jews were those who were circumcised into the tribe and followed the commandments. In the Christian tradition, it was those who accepted the creed. Islam is those who practice the five pillars of the Islamic faith. But it's still this idea of the one true community and the idea of an ethical response to the world. We talked about myth being something that has to be participated in to really be effective. But one way to participate in myth is to engage in a ritual, put on a mask, an act of pageant. But another way to enact a myth is to live an ethical, purposeful life. And so in the development of Judaism, the emphasis was away from temple sacrifice, that kind of participation to following the commandments, being neighborly, helping widows and orphans, that kind of ethical dimension. And then in Greece, which is, where we get our concept for logos as well as mythos, the signature to Campbell is that of human reason and the responsible individual. So Campbell says you think of Job as kind of the characteristic image for the Levantine, that Job gets beat up by God, but nevertheless is faithful to the end because the power of the transcendent God is so awesome that you're fooling yourself and trying to go against it, you might as well just prostrate yourself. Whereas in Greece, it's more the idea of Prometheus, of struggling against the gods and kind of pulling up by our own bootstraps, if you will. So, those to Campbell are the four domains. One place they are kind of like this. He likens mythology to poetry, and in the sense that mythology is not intended to be a literal historical description of events, but an image that inspires and fulfills these four functions that he put on there. And in terms of mythology in religion, Campbell said, there's the true poetry of the poet, which is kind of the highest use of myth, and that's where someone has an original creative vision and puts that vision into mythic imagery to convey it. Jesus or St. Francis of Assisi or somebody like that, has some kind of original vision. And interestingly, Campbell puts the artist and the philosopher in that same category, meaning that the artist and philosophers can have those same kind of visions that they're original and creative and meaning-producing. But at a lower level, you have what he calls poetry overdone by the prophet. What he means by that is poetry that's taken too seriously and too literally, and not only that someone should understand and get the poetic image that's created, but that they should make a fetish of it and kind of worship it in a stultified form. So that's what Campbell thinks of as prophetic. And then he says, really, below that is poetry done to death by the priest. By that, I think he means somebody that goes through the motions of the ritual without any connection with the original inspiration at all. They're just doing it by rote, because they've been taught to do the ritual. And Campbell says religion normally operates on two levels, but mythology has the level, really, in his system at least, to transcend religion. at least the way he uses the word. Talked about Kant and how he opened up the fields of ethics and aesthetics to other than a rational point of view. Friedrich Schelling was one of the German idealists, and he actually had two phases. He had an early phase where he was intermediate between Fichte and Hegel, and that's the way he's most often presented in the history of philosophy. But he actually outlived Hegel by about 20 years, even though he was a few years older than Hegel, and came back to the University of Berlin to give lectures in 1842. And in those lectures, his primary topics were mythology and revelation. And so he's probably done more work on the philosophy of mythology than any noted philosopher. But in typical dialectic form, I'm going to jump forward and go back. Hegel presents this as a typical thesis, antithesis, synthesis of the development of mythological views. And so in Schelling's development, the first theme to emerge is basically the toys for children thing that we started with. There's no truth at all in mythology. It is either meant merely poetically, and the truth found in it is merely contingent, in other words, living in Santa Claus, or it consists of meaningless representations that ignorance produced, in which the poetic arts later developed and combined into a poetic home. That's sort of like a logical positivist view, you know, it's a meaningless statement, you know, where people combine all these meaningless statements, but that ultimately they don't really do anything. So that's the thesis in Schelling's dialectic of myth. The antithesis in it is really what emerged with these structural functional views, and he cites kind of a lot of not so well-known writers there that I guess are more well-known in the 19th century, but he says the antithesis of that point of view is that there is a truth in mythology, but not in mythology as such. The mythological is either a mere form disguise of a historic truth, you know, meaning that it's kind of not so good history, you know, it's sort of watered down history. And Eumeros was a Greek philosopher who held that view, and you sometimes hear the verb Eumerization because of that. Or it's a disguise of a physical truth, or it's a misunderstanding or distortion of a scientific or a religious truth. So there, it's kind of, it's true. It's not just a fiction, but it's true at some lesser level. You know, it's kind of a second-tier truth. But in Schelling's system, those points of view lead to the synthesis that there is truth in mythology as such, which in his point transcends either view. What does he mean by that? In Schelling's view, myth is a theogonic process. What does that mean? That means theogonic means the history of the gods, as cosmogonic means the history of the cosmos. And so Schelling is saying that the process of myth is a process by which the divine itself evolves. Because in the idealistic tradition, whether you're talking about Hegel or Schelling, the point of the dialectic is for the subjective know itself as object in the dialectic. So here the subjective ground, or avoid using words that might be understood in a different sense, the subjective ground through this process of dialectic, that there's a demand or a command made to this ground, and that draws it out. And that the essence of humanity is to be a God-positive creature. In other words, to posit views of the divine that are ways for the divine to know itself as object. And so the meaning of mythology can only, to Schelling, be the meaning of the process by which it emerges into being. So it's a dialectical process of the subjective knowing itself as object. And that's what it's about. Now, finally, after supernormal science stimuli here, we're about to get into Q&A time. This is an oyster catcher, which is a kind of bird. I'm not sure exactly what the habitat of the oyster catcher is. I presume it's somewhere near the shore. And you notice that there's three eggs here, picked from of different sizes. The two eggs that are not being clutched by the oyster catcher are of a size that might be produced in nature by an oyster catcher. But what the animal behaviorists have found is that the oyster catcher will always prefer a supersized egg that is impossibly large for anything that the oyster catcher would ever encounter in experience, and will always gravitate to that side more than anything that is natural. There are other examples of this. Birds that value dark hues in a mate, and that if you produce an artificial stimulus that's much, much darker than any male she could possibly find in nature, that she will nevertheless prefer the abnormally, ridiculously dark, to what's available. And so this is what Campbell means by a supernormal sign stimuli. What the animal behaviorists have discovered is that all animals, including humans, have these features that are called innate releasing mechanisms, or IRMs. And that is a mechanism that can be released by an outer sign that draws forth the energy of the mechanism. An example of that would be sea turtles hatch out of eggs. They've had no experience, seeing anything. They immediately have to know to go toward the ocean, not up to the beach, or they won't survive. But they have this pattern in them that immediately recognizes the seashore and goes to it. And so they have this mechanism in themselves that as soon as the egg cracks, they can see, they go, oh, that's the ocean, I can go there. Some animal species have what's called a key-tumbler relationship, meaning that it's hardwired in. That the sea turtle, is only wired in for that one stimulus of recognizing the ocean. He can't be taught anything different. Other animals have a more flexible response, and think in terms of what we talked about, the archetype of the tongue, this form of which the content is filled in. So, for example, when Conlab Lorenz did his study with ducks, he could teach the baby ducks to imprint on him as the mother duck, because they were the first ones that they probably came out of the egg. And so they would follow him around, as they were. And so there you're using an imprint to determine the response, not just a built-in response, I'm going to look for the ocean. And in human beings, Campbell posits, we have this internal mechanism that is designed to respond essentially to larger-than-life myths, or images or myths that are put in front of us that transcend our historical reality, but nevertheless have the power to draw out of us this energy that results in creativity, advanced knowledge, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The existentialist made use of myth. Nietzsche talked about Apollonian and Dionysian characteristics. Camus wrote a book on the myth of Sisyphus, how the Greek myth of Sisyphus could give meaning, to what otherwise might be a meaningless kind of observation. So Campbell is seizing on this, providing kind of an animal behavior sort of explanation for why it might be. And so that's the supernormal sign stimuli. And so the thesis here basically is that myth is more accurately described as a supernormal sign stimuli, that we are by nature designed to react to, than it is reported for children. And that the challenge of our current environment is to come up with myths that are creative, playful, adaptive, not coercive, that can be shared across cultures, that are world-centric, not metrocentric, that honor the place of the earth, that honor the masculine and the feminine, and so forth. And arguably, we're coming, Campbell talks a lot about things like Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, those kind of things. If anybody believes that myth no longer has any power, we've had a couple of very destructive myths
the 20th century. Nazism built largely around the myth of Aryan superiority and so forth. Marxism also built around a certain kind of conservative mythology. And so we might consider whether we want to help formulate more useful, helpful inspired myths than those. And even the idea of the American dream of living in the suburbs with two cars and a garage and a grass lawn, that could be a deal. It's the image we hold that we find meaning from and that kind of motivates us to get up in the morning. Another description. So that's kind of the time for the lecture part, so I'm happy to go into the Q&A.
Observations?
Reputation?
Since you mentioned Wallace at the point, somebody threw it out, I've looked at that for years, and one of the things about it is that it seems to bring archetypes and blend very well with the scientific approach to nature. It's like there's a brotherhood of science on one hand, and archetypes on another, they really relate. For example, the energy centers on the human body and the human form seem to track not only religious theories of creation, but when you actually start looking at the universe in terms of Big Bang theory and the way stars and planets and things evolve, you can actually see these same matters that are tracking energy centers on the human body mapped out there cosmologically in ways that we now know are scientific and sound. Some of the populistic theory had to do with illnesses and masking on different sides of the head or whatever. We actually know from neurology now a lot of that stuff has a real basis in it. So in other words, there's a scientific basis on that. So it's just that some of the archetypes might be actually almost like blueprints for things in nature. Person has a high level of understanding and be able to make the separated stories about what the mythology and really see the archetypes as scientific designs. I'm saying a little about that, but it's just observation.
Yeah, I agree with the observation. I have read quite a bit of work on the Kabbalah, and I think it pretty much, you know, well fills the core functions of camp. You know, it can be used psychologically. You know, it can be used to produce a kind of awe, you know, the aha experience. It provides a cosmology that can fill in the blank that Brian Green's talking about here about, you know, what happened, you know, at the Big Bang as opposed to the second after. And you know, it can be a certain social function that, group adopted it as sort of a common vocabulary. So, I think the challenge of modern mythology is to be consistent with scientific understanding and not, you know, at odds with scientific understanding, because any modern myth that is contradicted by science, I think, has definitely value. So, value myths to me are the ones that can incorporate science.
There's a view put together with the different story and also how Babel is leader of Chimrock. That's been divided, but there's an explanation for Chimrock's wife, Samaras, named Samaras, and they had a son named Tommy. And Tommy worshiped after scattering the people. Tommy is a theory that is a forerunner of all non-Yahweh religions. And you trace it down to Ham, Egypt, which is called Mizraim. that?
Well, Tommy's, when he talks about the dead resurrected God, he was, you know, resurrected by the goddess. Tammuz was the Mesopotamian, you know, example of that. And corresponds to, maybe all this memory or not, but it's Adonis in Greek and Osiris in Egypt. And there's a Hittite variant, and there's Assyrian. All of those Middle Eastern cultures have some variation of that story, but Tammuz probably is the oldest one because Campbell told that Sumer and the Mesopotamian state were really the source of this hieratic state. Then the Egyptian and the Indian and Chinese really were influenced in that, you know, over the late periods of time. And so that they all would have been adaptations of that.
We're happiest when we're working on you know, growing something, whether it's a career or a garden, yep, children or whatever, you know, we want that. So to grow something, you have to kind of have a model. You know, like you're saying, if you want to work out and be a basketball player, you know, maybe your model is Dirk Nowitzki, you know, and so that's your myth, you know, that you want to. If you have no idea, you just kind of go out there and dribble around, you know, then that may not be so human. I mean, we may be wired in to have these transcendent goals. And part of Campbell's thing, the reason his last volume is Creative Mythology, is he's saying that in the current environment, we need to be more the author of our own mythology instead of just having the mythology and culture we're born into. You know, for a long time, you know, if you were born, you know, Hittite, you know, you had a Hittite mythology. You know, if you were born Hindu, you had a Hindu mythology. In this world, we can, you know, kind of create our own mythology, still share it with others, but be the architect of it in our own. So that's kind of what I'm saying. I think that sports and the it is a good example. I mean, I think that's why People Magazine sells so many. I mean, why are people so interested in celebrities? You know, because they perceive that as bigger than themselves. They don't find enough meaning in their own life. You know, they want some supernormal. You know, because they're more famous. You know, more people have heard about them. They want some more supernormal stuff.
Just a remark about the mood in your
I have not, but thanks for the reference. Is that out of date?
It's an old book.
From an evolutionary biological standpoint, or even ever been out of a psychological standpoint, we didn't like a creature because it was a mode of survival. And even the atheist has his bits on the score. But my problem is this, and it relates to something that I studied in the culture. Language, a sign and a symbol. In language, a sign represents something that is objectively different. But the symbol, we argue, participates in the reality of that object. So I want to know from you, from the standpoint of Campbell and Young, how does this participate in a reality? Is this, you know, a transcendent? Supernatural, or are they just those personal archetypes that symbolize, I mean, they're signs, not symbols, of the needs of, as you pointed out, that we have for these myths in order to have meaning and to be able to get them out of it?
I would say proper function of it is more of a symbol than a sign on Tillich's definitions, and you know, probably the closest, you know, I came to illustrate that with the slide of Schelling. You know, Schelling can be kind of difficult to grasp, but it's kind of hard in 5 minutes to really present it. You know, I could have a whole hour of Schelling, but maybe another time. But you know, the reason that Schelling would be a symbol and not a sign is that the positing of the myth actually brings it into being. You know, I mean, it's just potential, you know, pure subject in the idealistic sense. Yeah, which is not actualized. And so to actualize it, you have to posit the myth. And as he says, the only truth of myth is in the process of mythology itself. And so if that isn't a symbol, I don't know what is, because you're not just pointing to something, you're enacting it and participating in it and bringing it into being.
So the being is an important aspect of the subject, and we need those things but it's not being.
That's what you mean by reading. I mean, that's, it's not actual. It's not.
I was going to say, in our firmware, we basically have our collective art. We are in
escapes us because the science contradicts reality. So this reality is not possible. So we really can't have a mythology. Yet we're built for it. So there's a real contradiction, which maybe is a purpose of theology or psychology. There's a lot together.
Well, there can be a contradiction, but I don't know that necessarily has to be a contradiction, because there may be things like Ryan Green's question of what banged and why did it bang and those kind of things that science can't get at. I mean, that was Kant's conclusion, is that there is such a matter that logical reasoning can't get at. And to that extent, it's really impossible for science and myth to be in conflict. But I think the conflict happens when you over-literalize and over-concretize myth, because that may not be the highest. It's kind of like Campbell's scale. That's when you have the priestly use or the prophetic use of myth in his terms to the artistic myth. It's when you're trying to use myth to say, the earth can't be more than 7,000 years old. That may be a misuse of myth, because you're trying to make it now about factual history and not about origins.
But that's what I was trying to say. In science, is filled with mythology. Everything is mythology. It's a function of imagination, and it was there for survival purposes. Was part of evolution. It's not something that's
made up. Yeah. And the best scientific mythology should ultimately be the proof of the experiment. I mentioned how Einstein did it theoretically first. And there's no doubt he was convinced in his mind that it was absolutely true because of the beauty and the elements of the theory, without needing the empirical truth. Actually, Brian Greene's other book before he wrote this one called The Elegant Universe, that's pretty much the premise of it, is that scientific truth can be known as much for its elegance, as by its congruence with experimental fact. And so, from that standpoint, there need be no conflict. I mean, the myth can be the scientific theory. The unproven scientific theory is the myth.
A metaphor doesn't stick to the reference. I think Campbell says that. Metaphor doesn't stick to the metaphor. I feel without that necessarily being locked into this historical
tradition. Right. Right. Yeah. I didn't get it. The title of his book is "The Mask of God." For a reason, because it goes back to that participation, in the ritual of the myth, and one of the common ways of doing that is the pageant, where people would don the mask and play a character. If you're going to enact the ritual of the dead and reborn god and the rescue by the goddess, and somebody plays the goddess, not plays the goddess, you go do it all. And his point is, if you get frozen into thinking the mask is, the mythic, then you're missing the whole point, And so the whole point of the mask of God is not to get fixed with the mask, but to kind of see through the mask, see beyond the mask for us.
In the limited frame, that would be a horse. In the limited frame, it's like a magic love to me. And it's so beautiful, so nice. Again,
it has this agony
worship.
I'm going to say, the need for sacred space is now more apparent than ever, and it's hard to come by. But we need that inner sanctum. Meditation, whatever form you want it, it's a miracle, it's a miracle. I don't know what myth or psychology it comes from, but it's a miracle. In spite of the world that's about to tell us that it's not possible.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Kind of piggybacking off of what Carl was asking. Carl was saying, well, we're not just knowing the real universe isn't that enough. Which is a meaningful question itself. Suppose, I don't know if I made my answer to this, but the scientists want to they kind of presuppose that there's an order in the universe. Is there a reason? I mean, and to boil everything down to principles or predictables or laws, is that fulfilling the same need as?
Yes.
Is it the innate need that we have to create meaning that does that?
Yes, interestingly enough, Schelling, and to a lesser degree, Campbell talk about Hume as one of the kind of illustrators of myth. You don't know anything about him. Hume is a mythic person, but just for that reason, because Hume so thoroughly demonstrated that any belief in sort of a regularity, you know, is itself belief of faith in a way.
Belief of the causal universe.
And so the myth of the scientist very, very well believe. I mean, were you here for the scientist that spoke in September? I can't remember his name, but you know, he was saying that a lot of times the experimental data in practice gets reinterpreted to fit the curve instead of, you know, you smooth it out, you know, like you're looking for something and you have the experimental things here, but what you're projecting, and you'll try to explain away the deviances by, well, that's inaccurate measurement, or you know, there's some kind of extraneous factor. And so, and he was a practicing scientist, you know, so his point was, when scientists do science, you know, they're really not usually just saying, okay, I'm agnostic, you know, let's see what the data shows. I mean, generally, they've got, you know, a theory, a myth, you know, but that's not saying occasionally couldn't change it, but their approach is really from the standpoint of, you know, this is the myth I'm subscribing to now, and, you know, I'm doing the thought.
All right, thank you, David.